today about looking outside the box, so to speak. I know that we wanted to talk some about developmental issues, and we probably will throw some thinking in there, some thoughts in there. But I'm always have been concerned about when it seems like theory or techniques don't work or don't fit. And usually in my world, that means that somehow what we're how we're perceiving things or how we're delivering things probably need to be viewed from a different kind of angle or lens. And I had thought at one point of kind of entitling this talk, Imago Changing the Figure and the Ground, kind of reversing maybe what we think has been so important and looking at it from a different angle. In 2003, and I don't know if I wrote it in 2003 or presented it in 2004, put together a workshop called the Reactivity, it was about the energy grid, and it was about the reactivity dash dialogue continuum. And in that time, or in that workshop, my main premise was is that different clients come into us with different sets of problems, and I think we need to know those clients and be able to connect with them in different ways and deliver Imago in different ways or deliver the dialogue. I don't know about you folks, but and I am curious about this. I want to I'd like to get feedback in just a minute from all of you. When Sherry and I learned Imago 20 years ago, the premise was is you get the couples facing each other as quickly as possible and try to get them to do the couples dialogue. That's kind of what we learned. So I'm curious, what did you folks learn? Like, get feedback?
Same thing.
Okay, same thing for you, Rena. Okay.
That's Sue Ann.
Oh, Sue Ann. Uh-huh. How about others?
About the same.
Yeah, what Rick's saying is, you know, when we were trained back in you know, 19, 20 years ago, that was the direction you took. As quickly as possible, you teach the dialogue process, you get them mirroring, validating, and empathizing, and it's so you can obviously step back and let them do the work, and you become less important as they learn how to take care of their own issues, resolve their own childhood wounds, and that's wonderful. But what I was raised is, you know, I think all of y'all probably know, I just have finished up my master's, and, you know, having started with Rick, we had been married 5 months when we went to Harville's Getting the Love You Want workshop. So, you know, I only have known Imago until I started in my master's program. So I was raised in the church of Imago, and I thought that that's what you did. That's what you were supposed to do. And then we've been at a couple of meetings with other Imago therapists as we've began these discussions about the attachment wounds and how that shows up in the relationship and how it's played out across the developmental stages, and then how also it's important that attachment wound, at whatever level it is, how the therapist uses that in the office to make contact with the clients. And what we're hearing from a lot of different therapists is that they, too, are also seeing that there has to be a lot of profound work done before we can move clients immediately into dialogue, and that work is centered around learning, observing, and using the attachment wound to make contact and to join with the client so they trust you to take them in the right direction therapeutically. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh. Yes.
Yeah. So, The some of the concerns or observations I've had is that one of the premises in Imago is that symbiosis is what creates problems. And there's a paradox that if you try to impose Imago theory and technique onto people, then you can also be trying to impose symbiosis, saying this is the way it should be done or the way it needs to be done. So there's kind of a weird paradox that kind of gets set up there. And I do think, you know, we need to help people dialogue and make connection. That's what it's all about. But also we need to do it in a way that doesn't become symbiotic on how things should be done. Interestingly, some of these concerns I want to just share that have triggered all this for me is that one is John Gottman back in the 70s wrote a book on communication, couples and communications, and said this was a royal road to helping couples be different. And then in the 80s and the 90s he came out with his newer stuff and said communication stuff doesn't work. So I found that kind of interesting. I was aware that, you know, we had an organization that split apart, that even though we could dialogue, it wasn't enough to help us keep the organization together. And I know several people who have dropped out of Imago because they couldn't get their couples to dialogue, or it didn't work enough of the time, or they got busy trying to find other techniques and ways to make contact, and their Imago stuff became watered down. And then there's a couple other events that have happened. Sherry and I would predict that 95% of the people who come through the Getting the Love workshops find the workshops very profound, very helpful, and very meaningful. And we also would predict that clients who don't have a therapist, we would predict that 95% of those folks don't use the tools after they leave. And so then if that's accurate, then the question comes up for me, what is it that the clients are getting from the workshop that is so important, that is so meaningful and profound? Is it, if they're not using the technique, so they're saying I'm having a great experience, I'm getting a shift. And Sherry and I think at the core of that is that we're helping clients have a safe environment, we're helping them have a warm, empathetic experience, and we're helping them see the problems through a different lens. And if that's accurate, then we're taking that into the office. Initial work with your folks should be more around how do they have an empathetic experience, how do you establish contact with them, and how do you help them see it through a different lens. That becomes the figure, and trying to get them to dialogue becomes the ground. And so it's kind of switching things. And there are ways and times where we have couples dialogue all the time, but there's something about getting the figure in the ground reversed in that sense. So, okay. Is that making sense up to this point?
Totally.
Okay.
Yes. Would you repeat those again that you're trying to do in the session after the workshop?
Well, I've got all sorts of colleagues and trainees and people that have been through the workshop, and they say, oh, yeah, we don't even know where our manuals are. We don't dialogue. But we found the workshop really valuable. So the thing is and what is of value to them? And I think what they find of value is they have a weekend where they are in a warm, empathetic environment where they can feel connected. And they also get to frame or see the problem through a different lens or filter. The problem's no longer the way they thought it was. And if that's accurate, that people don't dialogue a lot after the workshop, and that people have a good experience of the workshop, then for me, that's something that probably needs to unfold in the therapist office, particularly if people have not gone to the workshop. And so then the question is, how as a therapist do you provide those experiences? And we'll talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's, again, like I was saying a minute ago, it's creating a sense of attachment with the therapist. And as you know, attachment in the parental child, in that arena, attachment, the best attachment is formed when there is contingent mirroring, which means it's accurate, and when there is marked mirroring, meaning that it is validating, you make sense to me, your tears make sense to me, but it's also offering the way out of the box for the child, and we're going to change your diaper. So there's accurate mirroring, and then there is the mirroring that validates and says, but we can, you know, we can fix this. And that attachment that is born out of that childhood, that perfect attachment, is, we know that's not, it doesn't happen in the real world, but that's what we're trying to create initially in the office between the clients and the therapist, hopefully getting, modeling that so that they can have that experience with each other.
So, let me make a few more comments and then come back to all kind of how to co-create this or have this happen. That there's a book out called The Heart and Soul of Change. Any of you familiar with that?
Mm-mm, no.
Okay. It's by Miller, Duncan, and Johnson. And they're having the revised edition come out in December. So if you're thinking of buying it, wait till December, and then you can get the updated report.
But what's the name of it again?
Explored therapy. And what they have found on outcome, what contributes to the outcome of therapy, that 40% of the outcome variance is contingent upon the client that walks through the door. So who your customer is and what they're like, their wounding, their stressors, and everything else, 40% of whether you're going to have successful therapy depends on that. 30% of the outcome variance is contingent on the therapeutic relationship, contingent on how well you can bond with your clients or with your couple. 15% is contingent upon hope. And another 15% then is contingent upon theory and technique. And less than 1% has to do with an accurate diagnosis or treatment plan. Everybody follow me on this?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love it.
Yeah. So it really then starts, to me, it starts to raise some questions. How do you accurately, in a sense, understand and diagnose who's coming through the door? And then the other part is how do you establish a therapeutic relationship with them in order to do that, you know, to make therapy meaningful? And if you're, again, if you're emphasizing theory and technique, you're only delivering a small portion of what's a necessary ingredient in the office. And I truly believe that the deepest wounding comes in the coupleship and the deepest healing comes in the coupleship. So I'm not dismissing that or trying to move away from that, but I am saying there's a third relationship that probably is just as important in the room, and that's the therapist relationship with the couple. And I don't think that I think we've talked some about that in Imago, but I don't think we've talked about it in depth. And so I guess I'm kind of on a crusade to start to make that more overt and to know when you need to be more central as a therapist. Because the piece is what Sherry and I found. If you can get a good relationship going with a couple, they'll do almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can have them mirror, dance, laugh, or whatever if you have a good relationship. If you don't have a good relationship with them, then it's hard to get them to do anything with each other. And so that's a real important piece. If you want to, the other thing, just a sidebar, Miller, Duncan, and Johnson have a website called thetalkingcure.com, and they have a lot of information and free downloads and everything else.
What is it again?
You can get more information about, like, that outcome variance and everything else. And let's see. Any thoughts or feedback at this point before I go on?
I agree with you.
I agree with you too, Rick, in that there's a difference between the goal and the method for getting mm-hmm. to the goal. And depending on who the people are, they come in with different degrees of defensiveness and fear. So how quickly they're going to go into using the method depends a lot on who they are, and that's where we come in to help them feel safe enough.
Show up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, for me, my name is Kathleen, my ability to kind of schmooze them and really know that they can be caught in a way doing something that was hurtful, but not feel bad about it. It's just a way of accepting themselves and not feeling judged.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the very important initial criteria is that as an imago therapist, you be able to model what it is we preach, which is, you know, I don't think you can ever be over-empathetic, over-validating, or over-mirror. Well, I think you can over-mirror, but I think, you know, that acceptance is just so imperative. It says this is going to be a safe place for you to come, and I think as a therapist you need to be aware of that in that process. So,
And Rick, I missed one of your words, and I can't tell if it was attachment or what. Deepest wounding and healing comes from what?
Oh, I think the deepest wounding comes out of our significant attachments, out of mm-hmm. our marriages or families of origin or whatever, the people that were. The deeper you're bonded with somebody, the deeper the potential for wounding.
And for healing. Great.
Yeah.
And Rick,
And as such, I think that, you know, there's been kind of this underuse or under-observance of the therapist. We want the couple to do the bulk of the work, but getting them to that place is a whole different thing. And Sherry and I have also talked that we think sometimes having clients look at each other and start to talk to each other is inviting post-traumatic stress.
Right on.
With some of the couples that walk through the door, that they're just that wounded.
Wow.
I mean, don't you have couples that they try to mirror or and then they derail or it escalates very quickly?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
You can usually tell
within the first session.
Yeah.
And I also think that a lot of times the individual in the couple is looking to the therapist to make sure that that individual is safe with the therapist before they can be safe with their partner.
Yeah.
Like you said, so you have to bond with them individually. It's a balancing act, but I think it's an important one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the point of, yeah, that I'm wanting to emphasize. That's right on target, mm-hmm. At least for my world. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now,
I see
one thing that Rick and I really noticed, and I tried to blame it on our website. We got a new website, and we would take registrations via the website, so there would not be any contact until they walked through the door. I would have never spoken to them, whereas prior to the website, they had to call me to register over the phone. Or you know, somehow there was always some verbal contact. And so I was blaming the fact that our workshops seemed to be bringing in a whole lot more early wounded couples on the fact that they weren't having to make contact. But I began to think a lot about that, and in my practice now, I would say that 90% of the couples I see are early wounded. I mean, they're deeply, deeply wounded. They're hard, hard couples to work with. And I began to talk with Rick about it, and tell me what you guys think about this. I'm 53 years old, and I think that what's going on is I'm beginning to see these people that are younger than I am, that are in such traumatic and stressful relationships, that they were parented by a two-parent working families. So both mom and dad were gone. They were in daycare from the time they were 6 weeks old. And so maybe their attachment issues are quite different than the ones from my generation where mom stayed home. And just wondering what you think about that.
Actually, I'm kind of seeing the opposite.
Really?
I mean, in terms of generational issues, because some of the younger couples that are coming in are just really much more, what is that term, emotional intelligence?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Self-awareness, capacity to talk about feelings, capacity to connect. So, I don't know, different experiences.
Yeah, it's nice to know that, you know, maybe just most of the early wounded couples are here in Raleigh.
We sent them all to you, Sherry.
Yeah. Well, that's maybe funny. Just in North Carolina.
Well, certainly if someone's lost a parent in an early age,
yeah.
Of course, isn't that interesting? I've had, my kids did. So for whatever reason, the earlier the attachment trauma or wound, of course, they lean on us more. And, of course, now that I'm older, too, I'm almost 62, that it's funny how the universe just sends to you what people seem to need or something. I don't know. But I am seeing people with a lot more woundedness as well, but I'm not sure why. I can't put it together necessarily, Sherry.
Yeah, just my musings.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder whether there's also something about the economy.
Yeah.
And the lack of safety.
Yeah, triggering stuff. Good point.
Yeah. Well,
that's an
excellent. Let me make a few more comments on this. That one of the things Duncan and Miller found in their research, that there's really two qualities that that make good therapists. And the good therapists are incredibly open to feedback from their clients, and they're flexible. Those are the two characteristics that make up in a good therapist. That's what they're finding in their outcome research. So it's imperative that you're always checking with your clients at the end of the session. In some ways, their experience with you, with the pace of the therapy, with the depth of the therapy, that you're always checking about that, and that you also are picking up on their attachment styles and their nonverbal to know how much to push, how much to lean back, and you as a therapist need to validate or stroke versus invite them to do something different. And in fact, Duncan and Miller and those folks have a form that you can download it. But basically, it's just a little check thing that you do at the end of every session with your new clients. You don't need to do it with your clients that have stuck and that are with you. But you just mark off four things like how I felt. I felt my therapist
heard me
today.
And validated me. So it's we have I thought we had one, Andy.
At any rate, it's about how you felt about the session, how you felt about the dance with the therapist, and so on. And what they're finding is
Here it is. Okay, the first one is relationship. And at the far left, it says, I did not feel heard, understood, and respected. Far right says, I felt heard, understood, and respected. So they can check or make an X mark, hash mark on any of this continuum. The next one is goals and topics. And far left says, we did not work on or talk about what I wanted to work on or talk about. And then the far right says the opposite. We worked on and talked about what I wanted to work on and talk about. The third one is approach or method. And the left says, the therapist approach is not a good fit for me. And the right says, the therapist approach is a good fit for me. And then the last one is overall. And the left says, there was something missing in the session today. And on the right, overall, today's session was right for me. And then they fill this out at the very end of the session. And then at the next session, this is where you go in the very beginning to just, you know, make sure that you're on track and they're getting what they need and they're feeling that they have a contingent and marked mirroring and that they are developing a good relationship with you.
Now, eventually, at any rate, Duncan and Miller and folks say that if you give those feedback forms to your clients and use them early on with your clients, you'll probably have a 65% better retention rate with your clients and a 65% better outcome with your clients. And I think this is real important because I've sat in sessions and I think clients are talking about I think they're just talking about what kind of ketchup to use. I mean, the issue seems so innocuous, only to come back the next session to say, you know, I just felt last session was hard, that I felt attacked. And in my reality, they were doing well, and so on. So when you get this, when they have a chance to take 2 minutes after the session and check a form, it's amazing that they will often check and reveal things that, as a therapist, you weren't aware of. And, again, it makes for great discussion when you come back. It lets you know how to further proceed with the couple, something about the timing and the tempo, whether it felt on target. And then, of course, you can mirror, validate, and empathize, explore all that to help, again, bring it back into the Imago processes to make it more effective. So any questions on that?
What was the name of the website again?
TalkingCure.com.
Talking Cure, okay. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
Well, Rick, as you're saying this is Atlantic. One of the things that dawned on me, and I had thought this years ago, but it reinforces how if you also ask for feedback, that it kind of invites the couple to work with you, not you work with them, that they're a partnership in the relationship.
Ooh, I like the way you're saying that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Good language around that.
Thank you.
So, in the early phases of therapy, and not going to talk this today, but we will talk it at the conference, Sherry and I are presenting with Sophie and Mike Borash on developmental stuff on one of the workshops, and that's going to focus more on the client who comes through the door, but I just want to make a few comments about the therapist, because in the early phases of therapy, there's really two goals. You need to help the couple join with you, and you need to help them join with Imago. If the couple doesn't join with you or doesn't feel connected with you, they're not going to be able to feel held and sit across from each other and do the work they need to. if they don't feel connected with your approach or with imago, that is, then you're not going to be aligned in the goals or whatever. So I say that because I want to invite you to think in that frame. And some couples will come into your office, and they've read the book, they've gone to the workshop, and they're ready to work, and you wish your whole practice was like that. Other couples will come in, they're under tremendous stress, you're the last stop before they go to the attorneys, they have trauma, and how they approach each other and how you help them approach each other is probably going to be very different. And, of course, most people who do imago therapy trainings and go to conference, we're already sold on the process. We bought the process, but a lot of times our clients are not educated and don't come through the door knowing much about it. And, again, it's a continuum, and as I think in order to be an effective therapist, you have to be aware of that continuum. So what are some things Sherry and I came up for? How do you help clients connect with you and the process in service of helping them reestablish their connection? You're always wanting to get back to them, help them reestablish a deeper connection between the two of them. But one of the things is I think it's very important as a therapist that you model what you preach, that you do lots of mirroring, lots of validation, and lots of empathy on both sides. I think early on that you need, as soon as possible, to help the couple understand that they're in a dance that they're co-creating, and that the dance that they're co-creating, the way they're trying to defend and protect themselves, perpetuates what they don't want. And that it's not the person across from them that is the problem, it's the dance cycle that they're in. And these first two things, I think, are what people get out of the workshop. They feel held empathetically. They feel like they've been in a good holding environment for the weekend. And they get a reframing of the dance that's going on between the two of them, that they're both co-creating something and they're both co-responsible for getting out of the box. So, again, I think those are early things that need to get presented to the couples, in a sense more so than trying to get them to dialogue. The other thing with highly reactive couples, and I don't know if you folks ever trained this or used it, but I use the core scene quite frequently. With couples, there's a core scene and the core scene revisited. I think this is a way of helping couples de-escalate when they have quite reactive energy. Let's see. The other thing, too, is I use a lot of guided imagery or mindfulness to help people who are in the early stages of therapy to feel safe in the office, to slow down the energy. And then early on also with couples, as they're talking about their issues and their problems, I don't use this. Sometimes I pull the actual map or structure out, but in the Keeping the Love Manual, they have the page on I observe, the story I create, what I feel, what I do, what it invites. But I often work with couples who, from that framework initially, to help them look at, to start to take the energy back into themselves. Instead of doing projecting or finger pointing or whatever. I tell most of my couples, you get one sentence about your partner. You get to say one thing descriptively about what the event is, and then I want to invite you to talk about yourself. And then the last piece I want to comment on is that lots of times when I'm holding reactive couples or couples that have deep wounding, when I feel a piece of vulnerability has been revealed, that's when I'll invite dialogue. And, you know, I think the old way is if you can get people to dialogue, they will feel safe, feel vulnerable, and open. And I think it's more, I think it's a systemic thing that if people are held and start to become open, that's a time to invite them to be dialogical. And, you know, like, so if I'm staying kind of central for a while and say, God, I can imagine that created a lot of pain for you, and they start to tear at that moment, I might invite them then to say, you know, could you share more about your hurt with your partner? And then that opens up dialogue, and it works a lot smoother. And so it goes both ways. You know, I've gotten people to dialogue and become more vulnerable and open. But on the other hand, as I've held them, then it's easier to invite them to move that way. Do you have anything you want to add or say?
Yeah, that was great.
Okay, so we're going to pause here and take time for any questions or discussions. I think that's kind of all we want to say for today as far as lecture or education or whatever.
I have a question.
Sure.
A clarification. You said you used the core scene and the core scene revisited, and then I don't remember what you said next, but I didn't kind of get what you were referring to, how you do that.
How the core scene's used?
Yes.
Early in the core scene,
early in the
often I'll use it with a couple that's highly reactive. It's particularly good for couples who have a lot of anger with each other. But the core scene basically really helps them write down 5, 6, 7 dance steps that go on between the two of them. And it's written in such a way that you describe, like, when I come home and the house is messy, what I do is then how you react. When you react that way, I move over here. When I do this, you're doing that. And it helps them look at a dance that's going on between the two of them. And then when you move over to the revisited, the core scene revisited, you help them develop strategies on what they could do on both sides of the dance, so to speak, that they both have power to shift things. You know, a partner might be angry and deliver in an angry tone, and they could learn to monitor their tone. On the other hand, the partner across from them could say, I could really hear you better if you could soften your tone. So both have power to co-create something different.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that posted somewhere, or I don't think I've ever seen that.
Well,
we wrote one. I'll have to pull it out. We can read it to you, or I can email it. If y'all email me, or Rick, we'll email you. We'll email it back to you.
Great, thank you. Great.
Yeah, see, this is one of these lost things in Imago that I think was incredibly valuable, and then it's kind of like disappeared. Again, with dialogue being the royal road and the only thing, and I think there are a lot of things that, and a lot of subtleties that we do as a therapist that once clients are joined with you and once they believe kind of in what you're doing, you can get them to dialogue, parent-child, hold, whatever.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, I don't even remember it. I was trained so long ago, I don't even remember it.
Uh-huh.
I think didn't Randy Mason do a lot with that?
It from you know, kind of, or Rick did. I won't even take credit for it. Rick kind of rewrote it in more current language, and it's very useful. You get them to the sit. It takes them 3 minutes to fill it out, and then it's a wonderful tool. So my email is sherrystolp@msn, and Rick's is rickstolp@msn. And either
dot
one
com.
Of dot com, yeah. And if you send it to Rick, he'll just send it to me, and then I'll send it to you. So either way.
Right. And what's the name of it?
The Core Scene and The Core Scene Revisited.
Thank you.
It should have been a part of your clinical training, but I think it's fallen by the wayside.
Yeah.
Nope. Well, it's kind of also it kind of implicit in the power struggle thing in the workshop when that couple says, "I when you do this, I feel this." And like,
yep.
Kind of in there a little bit, too.
Yeah. That's where a variation of that comes from.
Yeah.
And you can be creative and create your own. But,
yeah.
You know, I think that helping your couple join with you, helping them join with the process in service of helping them de-escalate enough, that then they can move into contact with each other. So, any other thoughts, comments?
No, this sounds-
I'm just glad, Rick and Sherry, that you're doing this, because I agree with you that, you know, it's you can't, I mean, the dialogue just isn't enough for a lot of couples. It just isn't. And I'm so glad that you're doing this. I'll join your crusade, Rick.
All right, good. We're on level now with at least another follower. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I see the dialogue as the technique and the tool, but that the real goal is about connection and using the connection and the relationship itself as a healing crucible. So sometimes the dialogue helps to create that, but sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I do keep most of the energy with the couples over with the couple. But again, I think what's kind of been missed or not explored is how the therapist is involved in that energy and relationship. You know, we cannot not be coaches. We cannot not have influence or impact. You know, I always, Sherry and I have talked that, you know, that there's nothing, I think, worse than a female that's trying to get her husband to open up and a female therapist is trying to get him to open up. You know, now you, I think it's much easier if you're a man in that situation to help that person, the man, open up. There's nothing like being a male therapist and having a male in the coupleship wanting his wife to have more sex. And now you're trying to help that process, you know. I mean, there's a nonverbal in all that, you know, that doesn't get spoken or addressed. And, yes, it's primarily the couple's issue, but there's a differential on what sex you are as a therapist, how you're working with them, and to be aware of that.
I have a question on this issue of inviting them to dialogue when one shows vulnerability. And the issue question I have is, so say you're in the third session or the fifth session early, but not the first or second. And so I'm kind of imagining that, that you have had the couple dialogue maybe about less reactive issues to get them used to the process, to make it a little safer, and that you do less dialogue when something terribly reactive and vulnerable comes up, and then invite them back into dialogue when that vulnerability is expressed in a way that they can manage. So is that a correct assumption, that you have them dialoguing on issues that they might be able to dialogue on, or are you primarily interactive with each of them for all three or five sessions until you get to a place where you ask them to dialogue in this most meaningful way?
Well, I'll tell you what. The answer is it's both. However, to quote something, and I'm probably going to get cut off here, but Aristotle once said, anyone can become angry. That is easy. But to be angry with the right person to the right degree at the right time for the right purpose and in the right way, that is not easy. To which I say, anybody can dialogue. That is easy. The dialogue with the right person to the right degree at the right time for the right purpose and in the right way, that's not easy. And I can get couples to come in, and, you know, often I will have them, often have them dialogue early on about a time they felt connected or how they go about creating connection. The dilemma is some couples will feel dismissed if you do that. They'll feel like you're not attuned to their pain or their issues. Like, as a therapist, you can't hold their world or their issues.
Sure.
And so, again, I think that has a lot to do with attunement. Mm-hmm. And if it feels like it's therapeutic, you know, they report, oh, this has been helpful, then great. If it doesn't, you know, then I think you have to come back and stay more central as a therapist.
So then, and given that last point, you might spend those first four or five sessions actually mirroring and validating each person separately in front of the other rather than having them dialogue with each other.
Yep.
Yes.
Might, for some couples. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, because I haven't found it a benefit to help couples share reactivities with each other. Sherry and I had a couple this morning that they're just so reactive with each other that the second they kind of turn and look at each other, the you statements start flying and everything. So, you know, Sherry and I held them for a little bit as we were doing co-therapy. We validated, we mirrored. Then when they started to settle, we turned them to each other and we had them then dialogue with each other. So there's something about the attunement of that.
I think when they're ready to speak from their heart, we get them to dialogue. When they're stuck in their heads, then we mirror and validate. It makes sense, and that you're experiencing that. But as soon as they can drop down into their feelings and share their feelings, that's when the shift happens. And for a lot of people that we're seeing, it takes a while to get them into their to feel safe enough to go into their hearts.
So if they are doing blaming, he, she, blah, 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 they're telling it to you, and you're mirroring it back in such a way to say, I hear you're upset with Mary, James, whatever, because of blah, blah, blah.
Well, kind of, but we really prefer that they take it out of you or she, he statements, even if they're speaking to us. You know, I'm experiencing, or the way I feel, you know, talking, you know, again, not only just among themselves, but with us, there's one, you know, you, them statement, those bad guys
yeah.
statement, but then it has to be a statement about how that the client
yeah.
is experiencing what that their
yeah.
partner is doing and
yeah.
what their feelings are, because the goal is to drop it into feelings.
Right. I got it now. And that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It would be easier.
And I would just add, it's an and. If the couple is healthier functioning or in a good spot, you have them dialogue and you can move them into vulnerability.
Right.
But some couples are so reactive, you need to hold them until they can get to some vulnerability, and then they can have a dialogical moment.
Right. And by allowing them only one blaming sentence and then going into themselves where they could not do that with their partner, that's not only a holding, it's also a discipline. I mean, it's a teaching. It's a demand.
Yeah.
That is unique and special that they will need, of course, when they dialogue.
Right.
So
exactly.
It's a training almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So. That was helpful. Thanks.
It's really modeling at first so they kind of get the ebb and flow. And then, you know, you're translating that back in once they are able to drop down into their feelings. You're helping them see how it's done so they can do it with each other and keep it safe. It's all about safety and intentionality, staying safe
yeah.
for each other and knowing which way you're going to face when you get in bed at night, either toward each other or back to back.
So kind of with Sherry's words about what you want to do in bed, we are going to need to pause in just a second. I hope this has been helpful or there are some ideas for some of you.
Very.
Yes, very good. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Good.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, be well.
I'll see you very much.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Rick and Sherry.
Goodbye.
Take care.